The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore, to drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. Measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been followed.
Center at Research Triangle. Listen now to our program called Soundings, Present and the Future. Your host is Wayne Palm.
The National Humanities Center series of conversations about the participants in the discussion are Vermont Royster, Hugh Holman, and Edwin Yoder. Mr. Royster is Keenan Professor of Journalism and Public Affairs in the School of Journalism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He was editor of the Wall Street Journal from 1958 till 1971, and he writes a nationally syndicated column. In 1953, Mr. Royster won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing. Hugh Holman is Keenan Professor of English at the University of North Carolina, where he has served as Chairman of the English Department, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Dean of the Graduate School, and Special Assistant to the Chancellor. Edwin Yoder is Editorial Page Editor of the Washington Star. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1979. The discussion for Soundings examines objectivity and accuracy, the nature of news, and journalism and fiction. Speaking in the following order are Vermont Royster, Hugh Holman, and Edwin Yoder. Here is Mr. Royster.
Well, I'm sure in some reporting, among some reporters, there maybe is a conscious effort to point a story one way or another. But an awful lot of the problem with the news story, which Hugh is talking about, is that it is often very difficult for the reporter to see more than a small part of the story.
Sure.
For example, there is a riot, and the reporter goes rushing over to the riot, and he sees some policemen with billies beating on some poor guy's head, and he puts this into his story. And what he didn't see, because he didn't get there in time, was that these same people had tire chains and were taking after the police. In other words, he saw only a part of the story. Now, you mentioned the situation in Greensboro with the problem you had up there with the parade, and the people got killed. To try to unravel that, a reporter going out, particularly in this case after the fact, he inevitably only sees part of the story. And with the best will in the world, and with the effort to be as intellectually honest as he can possibly be, it is still going to have some distortions inherent in it.
Let me suggest
really objectivity, isn't it? More of the blind man and the elephant again.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of it is the blind man.
Let me suggest an elaboration here, if I may, based on something Ben Bagdikian, who is a keen student of the journalistic craft, has suggested in one of his books called The Information Machines. And that is that in many cases the most decisive element about what the shape of reporting in journalism is what is left out. And he proceeds to give this example. It would have been possible for a concerned member of the Humane Society, if there had been such a thing in first century Rome, to have written a pitiful story about the plight of the lions in the keeping of the emperor, in which the decalcification of their bones was remarked upon, the poor state of their health and how skinny they were, undernourished and so forth, leaving out the key fact, which was that they were being starved to eat Christians. And if that, which was the central point of the story, had not been a perfectly factual, it could have been a perfectly factual story about the state of the lions, but would have missed the essential point. I also want to assert, if I may, going back to this question of who are we to set ourselves up as commentators on the passing scene, an even somewhat brassier rationale for what we do, and that is that it is remarkable that given the busyness of most people at doing what they mean, how lacking sometimes in balance and measure spontaneous judgments and reactions and opinions are about passing events of importance. Now, I think you can draw up of crimes of editorial pages, but one of the few things I think we occasionally do write comment with some measure, dispassion, of balance and perspective. I would simply submit that in doing so and having fulfill a function for something which will give shape and balance to their own spontaneous opinions on things. I listen driving home in Washington almost every afternoon to one of these radio call-in programs in which the two of our journalistic colleagues are there every afternoon. People call in and talk to them. And I'm struck by two things. One is the high degree of intelligence and information which comes up out of the rank and file telephone caller, and yet the equally high degree of eccentricity and sometimes I wouldn't want to say wildness, but certainly extravagance of view that you get, which would not be characteristic of very many editorial pages, unless we're talking about our friend Mr. Loeb on the Manchester paper in New Hampshire. Maybe that's a failing in editorial journalism. Maybe we're too lacking in color, but I think we do introduce a balance and measure into opinion making, which may serve a purpose.
What is news, on the other hand? Has anybody ever figured that out?
No, news is anything that happens in the world that people are interested in. And the thing that separates a successful editor from an unsuccessful one in terms of handling the news is that he shares the interest of his community. And Bill Grimes, who was my predecessor at the Wall Street Journal, always said, well, I decide whether to print a story or not, print it on whether I'm interested in it. If I'm interested in it, I print it. If I'm not interested in it, I don't print it. And it comes about as close to settling this question of news of anything that I know. Well, and Bill also said, if I get too far out of step with my readers, first thing you know, I don't have any newspaper to edit.
Well, Vermont, I think your definition goes far, but I don't think it goes quite far enough, because I agree with you, if you bore your readers, you're not going to have many readers left. What is news depends on what your criterion of news may be. Now, there are lots of things of great significance which are going on constantly, which are not given the attention space that many passing, ephemeral, and trivial things are. That is the hazard of saying news is what I think it is, because there are lots of things going on we know for a certainty which we are not aware of, and many things which indeed we are aware of which we do not report because of the conventionality of our criteria of what news might be. I mean, it may be that something going on in a scientific laboratory, which is very difficult to report intelligibly to the popular reader, nonetheless is ever so much more important than even the most important State of the Union address.
But aren't we really defining news here in terms of a community, a communal interest?
That's right.
Because let's take Charles Darwin set sail in a ship in England. To a certain extent, that's one of the most important events in the history of the modern world. It's not news at the time that it happened. Nobody was interested in it except probably his wife and a few friends. And the thing which would have made it something attractive to the community that constitutes the readership of a given newspaper
But the news
was absent. So that in a sense, one of the differences between journalism narrowly defined as we are talking of it now and history is to be found right here.
That's right.
That history seeks out those events which become significant in the fullness of time.
Yeah. I agree with what you say. It would have been humdrum news indeed that the Beagle was leaving and Darwin was on it.
Yeah.
Because the news, in a sense, in that case hadn't happened, because it hadn't gotten to the Galapagos Islands and he hadn't made his observations on variation of species. But I'm thinking of somewhat different examples. I'm thinking about things which are known, let's say within a limited circle of people, to be of, or at least to be asserted to be, of enormous significance, which we simply don't report very much about because it doesn't come into the compass of our own narrow, circumscribed and parochial interest, which is the
Afghanistan,
political activity.
Afghanistan is a splendid example of that. If one of your reporters or somebody had written a long story a year or so ago about this trouble in Afghanistan, and it sent out over the wire, not many newspapers would have given it a lot of space. If they had, not many readers would have read it. In fact, as you know, we have this cliche in the editorial writing business called Afghanistanism. When you don't want to get you in an argument with the Board of Aldermen, you write about the situation in Afghanistan, which nobody's interested in. Now, it could turn out subsequently, just like the voyage of the Beagle, that what happened in Afghanistan a year or 2 years ago is very pertinent. Right now, anything you write about Afghanistan, people will read. Because it's come into their commonality of interest. A historian can fault the non-publication of something about Afghanistan 2 years ago, but the simple fact of the matter is that you really cannot blame the journalist for not being able to see where the Beagle was going to end up any more than you can necessarily blame him for seeing 2 years ahead of time what something was going to happen in Afghanistan.
Well, it's like someone who decided to collect first editions of purely contemporary novels. He's going to spend an awful lot of money and fill his shelves with an awful lot of books that have no value whatsoever.
Correct.
six months after they're published, in order to get the small number that he wants, and it's an unprofitable venture. I remember very well going into the stacks of a library and discovering that sitting on the shelves were first editions of Faulkner in rather ragged condition because they'd been bought, and instead of being put in the rare book room, they'd been put on the shelves and circulated. They're now worth a fair amount of money, but how are you to know it in 1932 when Light in August came out? I mean, it's the same. It seems to me the same kind of problem. I think news is really defined for every newspaper or every news circulating medium by the community that particular medium is addressing.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
The National Humanities Center is pleased to present the second in a series of conversations about journalism and literature. The participants are Edwin Yoder, Vermont Royster, and Hugh Holman. Mr. Yoder is the editorial page editor of the Washington Star. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1979. Mr. Royster is Keenan Professor of Journalism and Public Affairs in the School of Journalism at the University of North Carolina. From 1958 till 1971, he was editor of the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Royster was the winner of the Pulitzer Prize in 1953. Dr. Holman is Keenan Professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he served as Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Dean of the Graduate School, and Special Assistant to the Chancellor. The Conversation for Soundings examines the nature of news and then turns to a discussion of journalism and fiction. Speaking in the following order are Edwin Yoder, Vermont Royster, and Hugh Holman. Here is Mr. Yoder.
But I think we're palliating here one of the signal failings of contemporary journalism, which is its preoccupation with things that are ephemeral and which are known by us to be ephemeral, like your New Hampshire primary, in which nothing happened, but which was made important simply because important journalists wrote a lot about it, and at the expense of things which are known to be important. But there are lots of things that we do not take scrupulous care to report about. I mean, I'm of the belief that while perhaps not everything can be made interesting to the common reader, there are a lot of things that could be made interesting to the common reader, which we do not choose to make interesting to the common reader, but which are nonetheless at least as important as Iowa caucuses, and probably a great deal more important, but which about which you will never see headlines on the front pages.
Yeah, but the reader himself does exactly the same thing. Even the most educated and intelligent elite reader of the New York Times does not read the newspaper from front to back. What he does is he goes through the newspaper and he looks at headlines or a picture or something, and if anything interests him, he will then read the story. If it's on a subject that doesn't interest him, he will just pass it by. Part of the failing you're talking about is simply a human failing. No matter what you did with your newspaper to live up to your high standards, you can lead the reader to the newspaper, but you can't make him drink it.
Well, but I think we're abdicating great. I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who's in the newspaper trade. I think we abdicate great areas of interest to magazines whose treatment of the subjects that we leave out may not necessarily be any more sophisticated or indeed any more competent than the treatment it might get from a good newspaper journalist. And which are immensely interesting stories that we simply think in the field of science is where they probably.
But no one publication can be all things to all men. It's impossible. And no publication in the world has sufficient room to do this. It's just like no one can write a complete history of the reign of Queen Victoria and expect anybody to read it. You would end up with a shelf that would be 24 feet long if you could compress it that much, because too much was happening in the world and in England itself during the long reign of Victoria. Any historian, just like a newspaper reporter, any historian selects out from the vast amount of material that he has available. And maybe he is interested in the scientific history of the 19th century. Maybe his main interest is the cultural history. All of these things are important. Maybe it's political history. Maybe it's the development of the constitutional law development in Britain in the 19th century. But no one history can get it all in, and a historian would be mad to try.
Well, I'm not arguing against
And the same
this.
Thing is true when you're dealing with daily events.
Isn't that the responsibility?
Isn't that a function, Ed, in part of the nature of the American experience as a national experience? To a remarkable degree, the United States, or America, even before it became the United States, found its fundamental issues of life and death politically stated, and still does.
Still are.
To a much greater extent than is true in the rest of the world, where you had different forms of government. And this became particularly important in the early years of the Republic, when you were engaged in the experiment of a government by the people, in which an informed electorate about political issues was an essential to the working of the system. And whether you actually had an informed electorate is a very open question. Well, it's not an open question. It's, unfortunately, it's a closed one. We didn't have. But it seems to me that almost everything about the American experiment as an experiment put a thrust in the direction of a political reading of the health of the nation, the well-being of the people.
I think that's true today, too, Hugh.
Are there writers who are both bona fide journalists and first-rate writers of fiction today?
Well, part of this is the inferiority complex we journalists have acquired from our English literature friends in academia. that we think that what when we write anything that's called, quote, journalism, end quote, that it's ephemeral and second rate. And no matter how hard we work at it and no matter how skillfully we may do it. But you raise an interesting thing, because one of the things that interests me is that the man of literature has disappeared from the scene.
The man of letters?
Man of letters. Mm-hmm. By that I mean the person who devotes his life to writing in all of its forms, who writes some poetry, who write a play, who write some short stories, who write a novel. I suppose, what, Somerset Maugham was the latest? Can we think of one
well,
more recent than Somerset Maugham?
We've got one today in Robert Penwarren, who is also a good journalist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those book, the little book on segregation, he speaks for the Negro, were good journalistic works, mm-hmm. and they were journalism. Mm-hmm. That's what he was doing. But he's a novelist, a poet, excellent poet. But
he's a rare species.
But he is about, extremely rare. We tend to look, this particularly true of Americans, tend to look on writing as such a grimly serious and highly specialized activity that the idea of being a journalist and a novelist and writing funny skits or light verse
within the latter part of the 19th century and even the earlier part of this one, particularly in England, there were quite a number of them. Somerset Maugham, H.G. Wells,
England is
Chesterton.
Much freer of this kind of frozen sense of the importance of form. Not only do you have people who distinguish themselves in one, say in politics, who have a, I mean, think of C.P. Snow, for example, as a, as an example of a man who was in, has been in public affairs, who's been in science, who is a controversialist and a journalist, and who is also, I think, a pretty good novelist.
And the latest work that he's done is a book that would be unthinkable for an American novelist at his, with his standing to have done. It's a detective story.
A mystery, yeah.
You know.
And that sense that the forms have a certain sort of equality and that to do good work in any of them is good, that the British seem still to have, we've lost, or if we ever had it, we've lost.
The amateur tradition, I guess, is
well, and our professional writers tend to get trapped. He writes the detective stories, and he writes a couple of them that are pretty successful. And the first thing you know, that's all he's writing is detective stories.
Yeah.
Or he's writing science fiction, he writes a couple of them, and they turn out pretty well, and the next thing you know, he's writing nothing but science fiction. So Paul Thoreau, incidentally, has been more successful with his, quote, journalism, end quote, or travel books, or whatever you want to call them.
Than his novel.
Well, than with his novel.
Yeah, and he's a better journalist than he is a novelist.
Right, he is a better journalist than he is a novelist.
We can also think of the curious phenomenon. I mean, not only are they journalists who hanker to be writers of novels, they're always novelists who hanker to be dramatists for some strange reason, even when they don't have, when they are fabulously successful tellers of stories, like Henry James. Henry James's great ambition was to write a successful play, but he simply didn't have the sense of that form to make it successful and was practically hooted out of the theater when his first play was produced, even though at the time he was a very distinguished novelist. Thomas Wolfe, our fellow North Carolinian, always aspired to be a playwright fundamentally, but obviously his talent was not suited to that, to the high compression of that form. I don't know why that is. Everybody's got an idea of some level. It's like a series of steps, and too many journalists think of themselves as standing on a lower rung of the ladder, a lower mm-hmm. step, and think of these other forms as existing at the.
Or of course, you take a man like Mark Twain, who wanted to be remembered for the memoirs of Joan of Arc.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is a dull book. Mm-hmm. A grimly serious and dull book.
Mm-hmm. And but you mentioned the Faulkner's Fable, which certainly by all
general
acknowledgement is his least successful mm-hmm. novel.
Been talking about individual writers. I wonder if you'd consider and describe the duty and the function of the journalist and the literary artist.
It seems to me that fundamentally both the journalist and the novel writer or fiction writer or whatever terminology the non-journalist are engaged in trying to convey to other people some sense of the world and of events that through their own eyes. The journalist does it in one form and the novelist does it in another. But even a novelist who's writing a historical novel about ancient Rome or the Middle Ages is in a sense trying to share with the reader not only his perception of the Middle Ages, but also giving it some relation to today. This is his ambition to do this, to give some shape and form to event. For that matter, of course, so is the historian. He's trying to give some shape and form to events as he sees them. The journalist is trying to do the same thing, but in a different form and in dealing mostly with different events. But still, they're both struggling with the same goal.
The writers, regardless of what the serious writers, and by serious I don't mean necessarily grimly earnest, but writers who are taking their craft seriously, it seems to me, are always trying to communicate a personal vision of experience.
That's right.
Whatever the materials they use to communicate that personal vision. And that therein lies one of their major values, one of their major virtues. And this can be done in journalism, it can be done in fiction, it can be done in essays, it can be done in poetry, but that's where the value resides.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Join me this week for Soundings, the Center's radio program, presenting the second part of a discussion about journalism and literature with three experts, two Pulitzer Prize winners, and an award-winning literary critic. Journalism and literature, that's the topic this week on Soundings.